University, the voice of Reichman University.
Beyond the uniform. Stories of strength, resilience, and rising to the occasion. With Rachel Safdi and Rachel Iskandri.
Hey, it's Rachel Safdi.
And Rachel Iskandri.
And welcome to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity, where we tell you the untold stories of the heroes of Israel.
Today, we have a very special guest who is originally from Brazil. He has a bachelor's degree in business administration and marketing and a master's in government diplomacy and conflict resolution.
He served in the International Relations Unit at the IDF, acted as executive producer at I-24 News, and today is deputy academic director at the Government International School in Reichman University. Fabio, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here. This is a little bit of my home. I had a show here for 3 years, so right? It's always good to be back.
Amazing. And just to remind our listeners, Beyond the Uniform is a podcast to show you the reality and the truth behind who Israelis are in general. A lot of people get their information on Israelis, and just in general, this context that we hear talk about Israelis is usually related to war and conflict and has this kind of negative context. And so our job here is to bring you some of the amazing, amazing people that we like to call Israelis, and to show you who they are before, beyond the uniform that they wear, if it's an academic uniform, if they're soldiers, if they're volunteers, if they're just citizens. And so we're very, very happy you're here with us today, Fabio. And let's start at the beginning. You were born in Brazil. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to Israel, a bit of your background?
Yes, I was born in Brazil, a very much 90s kid, even though I'm from 1996. because Brazil, it was kind of like slower than other countries. It was the beginning of internet. Everything that happened in the United States probably came to Brazil 2 years later. So I was very much a 90s kid, went to all the Jewish community. I participated in youth movements. I was part of Eber Aikeno, which is connected to the Maccabi World Union. I also was in many Jewish schools. I studied in Renascença, in Bialik, that now doesn't exist anymore. I studied in Peretz.
Me too.
Which also doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, also doesn't exist anymore.
And then when I got to my late time in school, I actually moved to the United States for a year, studying the American Hebrew Academy, which also doesn't exist anymore. I can see a
trend
here.
You make an impact in these institutions.
Come for a couple of years and then they close down.
It was good times. I really enjoyed it. I was part of this youth movement. We came here as a graduation. We spent a whole month in Israel with everyone to learn how to be better madrichim, to teach the kids how to engage, how to be Zionist kids from their communities, leaders for the tomorrow. And then when I came back from the United States, I had kind of like a self-discovery moment in São Paulo, in which I realized that I was more of a tourist in New York than I was in São Paulo. If you have been to São Paulo, it's an amazing place. It's full of hidden areas. It's a city of 13 million people, but it feels very warm everywhere. So if you go to São Paulo, don't think of it as like, oh, that's the big city, that is the place where I can like just get a layover to Rio or something else. Explore the city.
A lot of Israelis just skip São Paulo, yeah.
Yeah, when you talk about São Paulo to Israelis, they think Morro de São Paulo, which is very far away.
Bahia.
Yeah, it's an island in the middle of Bahia. There's like people from Bahia don't go there, but Israelis do.
Yeah, it's very misleading. Yeah. I am from São Paulo and I thought it was a place in São Paulo that I did not know. And just like a few years ago, I found out that it's not even in São Paulo.
Nope.
So when did you move to Israel?
I moved to Israel 6 months after coming back from the United States. Me and my family were already thinking about it.
Oh, you came with your family?
Yes.
How old are you?
Kind of. I was 19 when I came. My sister came 2 years earlier. She did the Nale program. Mm-hmm. She was first in Farrupin, then they closed the program. Everything happens, you know? They closed the program, she moved to Hadassim, and we all met here in different times. She came 2 years earlier. I came in January 2016, and my parents came in March.
Interesting. And you came to do what? You came and you drafted, or you came and you studied?
First of all, I started in Kibbutz Ulpan. I was hearing a lot from the Jewish agency back in Brazil. I was like, okay, what is the best way for me to succeed in Israel? What should I do? Also, Brazilians, we have this focus of, like, we don't do army, we don't do this. It's like, what is the next step? What is the, like, new venture? Let's always keep doing things. So with that, I was thinking, okay, I want to go to university. How much is it going to take for me? So I did the Kibbutz Ulpan. Learn Hebrew.
What is kibbutz and what is ulpan for our listeners?
Kibbutz is a community, very kind of like communist of old times community, it's mostly on the countryside. The one that I was in the beach. It was Magan Mihail.
Oh, that's the best one.
It's a beautiful one.
Oh, that's okay.
It's beautiful, but for someone from Sao Paulo to be in a place with only beach and not much going on, it's kind of like...
And it's super small.
Yes. It's
all
great.
The kibbutzim are.
Yeah, like, they're like tiny villages.
Yeah.
Yep. No, it's great for a weekend. If you want to have a getaway, maybe like, don't know, spa style, go to the beach every day. Amazing. If you're going to be there for 5 months, it's a little bit complicated.
So you were there to learn Hebrew?
Yes.
And did you succeed?
Nope. That is the thing with me. It took a while to get to Hebrew.
Same.
I think it's with Mosolim. You only learn Hebrew.
It's a really hard language to learn.
It is.
It's
like,
hard.
All of them, first of all, it's a different form of letters.
Right.
And it's the whole different base of the language. If you get to English, it's more Germanic, but it has some connections with Latin. Portuguese is Latin, so you learn Spanish, French.
Yeah, you French. Have some connections, yeah.
Hebrew is a whole new thing.
Yeah.
So how after your ulpan in kibbutz, Magan Mihail, you drafted and that's where you learned Hebrew? In the army?
No, it took a little bit longer.
It took more time. Wow.
It was a long process.
Yes. After 2016, I started because someone told me, a friend of my family told me, hey, there's this university. Like, I was living in Ranana. There's this university, like, very close from here. You know, you should check it out. And I was looking at the book from the Jewish agency back then and saying, like, universities in Israel, Hebrew U, Tel Aviv, this, that. Nothing about this place called IDC. When I came here for the first time back in, it was August 2016, fell in love with the place, said, okay, that is the place. Doesn't matter how much time it's going to take for me. I want to be in this place.
Wow.
So I studied business here for the next 3 years.
Okay, so you did university before you drafted into the army.
Yes.
Wow. How was that experience?
It was a great experience. I had to postpone my army service. I went through the Tzavrishon anyway. I lost class because of that. But overall, I think it was a good choice because it gave me some time to also understand the culture in the country. It allowed me to develop skills. I was doing business administration, so... To better organize what can be a mess. You both have been in the army. You know that a lot of the people are very young and they are not very inclined to organize things. Sorry, Israelis, even more Israelis. But I really feel that it also gave me some social skills that helped me develop. I always, whoever comes to my office, I show everything that I did during my BA. I was here in the radio for 3 years. I was the president of AIPAI. I was in Modo UN. I was
one of
the founding members of JLIC in the campus. I was trying to do everything possible. So this place really enables you to develop many different things. And I think that for the army, that also allowed me to have a social life besides the army.
For sure.
Was it very obvious for you from the beginning that you were going to draft after university?
Nope. And that is a little bit of funny thing. I didn't come to the army thinking I want to do the army. And I think that happens with a lot of people. I came from Brazil, a place that I had to run away from the army. In Brazil, it's mandatory for all the men to register when they are 18. they don't draft. They come there, most of them are released, and unless you really want to do it or you have no conditions to do anything but go to the army, you don't go to the army. So I came here with the mentality of, like, I want to develop and help this country in different ways. I was very young, so I had to mature a little bit more. I came there even, they said, like, I don't know, like, what do you want to do in the army? I said, I don't know, Galgalats? Like, I have no idea.
Galgalats is the army radio, for those who don't know.
I had no idea what I was looking for. And first going to the army, going to Mikhve Alon, also giving myself some time to see all the options, was Mikhve Alon is also where you do Ulpan. And this is the place where I started actually learning Hebrew. It took 4 years in the country for me to properly
start. Oh my God, me start. Too. Me too, same thing. I was here for 4 years before I actually had a Hebrew lesson. And it was only in Mikhve Alon, which is basically basic training. It's a 3-month basic training where in the morning you have gun class and in the afternoon you have Hebrew class.
Yes. While someone is yelling at you to do like, run there, yeah. do this. Yeah, I didn't like that part.
Me neither.
No, there is the place that I actually understood what I wanted to do. Also, I was way older. I was 4 years older than most of the people who were there.
And even older than your commanders.
I was older than pretty much all of my commanders.
That must have been a very interesting experience.
It was very interesting because by the end of the basic training, my commander came to me and said, Fabio, I don't understand it. Like, we tell you to do something. You do it in your own way. Doesn't matter what we say. And it works. And I was like, yes, I tried to use a little bit of logic, you know?
No logic in the army.
No, yeah.
So you were in the international relations unit branch. A lot of people don't know a lot about it.
Yeah, it changes the name all the time.
Yeah,
also.
Right. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So right after I finished with Mikhve Alon, it took some time also, bureaucracy here, bureaucracy there. I managed to get an interview to go to Kishrei Chutz, which is the technically foreign military relations. Now they changed to Tevil.
Tevil.
Yes. So Tiyum Ben Leomi, I believe.
It's international so it's foreign affairs.
Coordination between countries, stuff like that. Just rewind it in a bit. First of all, I didn't want to draft. Then I said, you know what? I'm drafting. I want to get to a place that I can actually do a difference and I want to work. I never do things halfway. So I came to the unit and I say, hey, I know that they send me here, but please send me to a place that I can actually work. I can
make a difference.
Yeah. So after 2 months, I pushed them and said, hey, can you send me like to this place, the Asians and South and Latin America office? I believe that this is the place that I can actually make a difference. After a lot of fight, a lot of bureaucracy, I got there. No one thing. If you're thinking about drafting in the military, it's all about of how much you want to push things. If you don't fight a little bit of the system, like be diplomatic, don't like fight for the sake of fighting. Come with an objective. If you do it, you're probably gonna get to the right place.
Yeah, a lot of.
Yeah, it's a lot of like standing up for yourself and learning that lesson.
I think the army does that, this concept of learning kind of a discipline, I think I would say. It really teaches you to fight for yourself. Yeah. So you got to the Asia Latin America branch. And from what I understand, this unit is about the contact between army to army.
Yes.
Correct? So what was that like?
It was very interesting. We had to deal with delegations of militaries, some of the militaries that I cannot even talk about, even though at the same time, Dovret Tzahal published it. Anyway, there are some relations that are secret that only the people who work in the unit knows, or like higher officers, like the head of the army knows. We sent him on delegations here and there. We also accompanied delegations from different countries. We have probably from the Latin American Asia countries, at least we have probably 30 or so attaches of these countries here. They're all coronels. So first of all, because I'm Brazilian, and none of the other Brazilians were in the office when I got there. It was such a different approach that I have instead of my commanders. I used to come to them whenever they had events and talk to them as like one-on-one, like, hey, how's it going? What about this? What about that? Make jokes. They started to trust me more, and we kind of like have a relationship. And by the end of my service, I was pretty much the unofficial head for Latin America. My boss loved Asia. That was his thing. So he said, whatever is Latin America, like, send it to Fabio. He'll deal with it. One of the things that I was crazy for, and I work also with Dover Tzahal, with Galit, who is now a third year, we tried to do a conference. It didn't work out because of timing, to explain Hezbollah in Latin America.
Very interesting.
This is a very big topic.
Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people know about Hezbollah.
That
presence
is what I don't understand. Yeah. And it was hard because many times you would say like, oh, I want to establish relations with Paraguay. I don't know if there is. Back then we didn't have. I don't know if the project went anywhere. Whatever. But people would ask like, why is it important? What is there? It's like, I don't know. There's only like representatives of Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, everything. The government is very pro-Israel. They want to do something about it. Why not help? And that was kind of like the engagement all the time, trying to present the different aspects of how we could collaborate with different militaries to mm-hmm. in order to fight the same fight.
Yeah, Israel helped stop also an imminent Hezbollah attack in Brazil. We have mm-hmm. a lot of terror presence, especially in that in south of Brazil, in the Brazil Paraguay Argentina
yeah.
Triple border there. But what did your day-to-day, what did your service kind of look like? Were you meeting with people from these different militaries, these militaries attachés here? Were you, you know, building bridges between, I met with a lot of American soldiers here doing a lot of different exercises also, which was very interesting. What did that look like?
So I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Most of the days can be a little bit boring. This is part of the job. Anywhere you go, there are days that you don't do much. Most of the days are paperwork. You have to approve foreign flights from militaries here and there. You have to deal with all the asks about information from different militaries. Once in a while, you also manage to have some fun days, like going on delegations. I went for the first time since I was in Mirvelon with a delegation of foreign officers. They wanted to know how Israel was absorbing the new immigrants and also the people who are in need of the country. They also sent it there in order for them to have a little bit of more of a feeling of community before moving to another position. They do a lot of different things like that. I had to do translation between a meeting of one of the military heads of the colleges area of the IDF with a Peruvian attaché.
Really
slowly, slowly you get to really experience this. And then by the end of my service, I was being invited to all the official events from the embassies. I went to a boat from the Brazilian military. The Brazilian Navy was coming here to Israel. They used to go every friendly nation. I don't know if they're coming right now. But they used to come to every friendly nation and really like have a party at every port. So I met them in Haifa. It was very fun, very good coffee, very good food, all the snacks, pão de queijo. It's a day that every day is a different one. You don't know what to expect. There are days that the conflict explodes, and there are conflicts that are not even involved in which we don't have direct involvement. But for instance, when I was in the army, there was the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and Israel had its participation in the conflict. Back then, only we knew about it. Nowadays, it's more open to the public. I was also in charge of the war month simulation, at least for Kishay Huds, which is very interesting because what I saw there was exactly what the head of the armed forces, Halevi, has said a few months ago. He said that we weren't ready for it. We were looking for, like, October 7th, the way that it happened, we were looking for the North. That is the only thing that we have to look for. It's Iran and Hezbollah. Everything else, not worth looking. And one of the things that I was really trying to do in the simulations was to prepare for the worst. If we can be ready to lose, then when it happens in real life, you know what to do. And we weren't really ready for it, and people didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting, the concept of war month. We have all over the army, pretty much, it's this kind of intense month where every single unit kind of practices or simulates, like you said, this concept of a war. And speaking of October 7th, and as you said, of course, I mean, our biggest threat was in the north. Our second biggest threat was kind of from within, or was, you know, in the West Bank. And the last priority was Hamas in the south. And then we saw October 7th. And by then you were already working at I-24 News, correct?
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you became an executive producer there, and how the war looked like?
Well, there's a whole thing. I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones. No?
No,
no one. Okay. So one of the things that one character, Littlefinger, says, it's chaos is a ladder. It can really push you down or up. It's also in the song "O Fortuna." I don't know if you know. It's a classic song. Worth listening to, very traumatic. But anyway, the fortune pushes you up or down. That is the whole concept. And that's what happened with me in I-24 News. I started as an associate producer. I came there because I had friends who were inside, actually alumni from the international school, and started from the bottom. I learned how to make videos, what to make video reports, how to start narrating videos and explore a little bit more of the options.
Mm-hmm.
October 7 changed everything. With October 7, I was raised to be the executive producer for the Spanish show, while I was also working in the English programming. It became a war zone. I wasn't called for Miluim because my unit in the army wasn't, like, Miluim is reserve service, if people don't know. Because my unit in the army wasn't looking for many people. We had a lot of people who were in the Sadiru, how do you say it again?
In their obligatory
service.
Yeah, in the mandatory
yeah.
service. And they only asked for the officers to do reserve service. So I was, in a way, doing my own Miluim for the media. I saw so many things that were a little bit traumatizing. And everything changed, and I was raised to this position in the Spanish show, which gave me a lot of freedom to do my own programming. I was working with Carlos Gurovich, rest in peace. He was a great mentor in that. And with Nicole Nicole Michel. I don't know why I forgot about it. Anyway, she was also great, and they were very into showing what's the story for the Spanish world. While I was also working for the English, so we went to the Nova event that they had in the Expo Center in Tel Aviv. We covered soldiers who have died, and there were events in honor of it. But at the same time, in the beginning, it was the craziest thing.
It's the only news from Israel, at least mm-hmm. in Spanish, I think. Or
yeah.
It was the biggest kind of news station. Now they opened a Hebrew channel, but it was English, Spanish, French, and they're very
international.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened in the day itself, I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I, on the October 7th, actually my story kind of starts in the October 6th, which was ironic for me. I was finishing my MA here. I had one more paper to submit.
Wow.
It was Simhat Torah. I was mm-hmm. ready to say, you know what, I'm going to stop playing video games at 4 a.m. and I'm going to just focus. Tomorrow is going to be a great day. Tomorrow I'm going to finish this paper and get done with my university. I'm awake by my dad at 8 a.m. saying, Fabio, what is going on? What's going on? Like, there's something going on in the South. I'm like, I don't know, I'm just woke up. And then the video started to surface. And then everything was going mad. And people from all over the world was reaching me. I was a connection between the media of Brazil and here. I had a friend, Carlo Cauchi, who also studied here for an exchange. He's the head of the kind of like the union of the international reporters in Brazil, the international journalists in Brazil. He said, Fabio, do you have anything? Can you say something? Can you help me? He also works for Revista Oeste.
Like people asking you for a statement because you were the connection of the Spanish like the and Portuguese. Man,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I spoke with Panico in Jovem Pan. I spoke with the news shows in there. I was presenting and giving all the content. So like, this is what is happening. I had to blur every single one of the images that happened in October
7
at I24 News because no one who worked with me could. Everyone who would see anything would cry.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there in October 7, but I was there in October 8. And the whole place was mad. No one understood exactly what happened. People were like very frightened. They allowed us to go to get cabs to work because we didn't know what was the secret situation. Mm-hmm. So we got there. And I understood how bad the situation was because we were going to interview someone who is a Nova survivor. One of our producers made a video explaining what was the situation based on the information that we had. First, we were thinking like, oh, apparently 20 people were in Gaza, were sent to Gaza. Apparently,
kidnapped, you mean?
Kidnapped to Gaza. Apparently 70 people were killed or something. 100 people got killed. We didn't have any idea until 3 days later.
I don't think many people did. Like, unless you were a soldier or somehow, like, in the army and got the information, a lot of people in Israel were really, really confused for the first couple of days about what's going on, how are we going to handle this, how long is this going to last. Like, a lot of people also didn't realize that, you know, it was something that we would be in for 2+ years afterwards. Like, nobody could fathom that idea.
And you're the news, right? Yeah. So it's like you're supposed to be giving that information out to people, but you yourselves have no idea what's happening because at the end of the day, we're all just, you know, Israeli citizens. Right. Doesn't matter what hat we're wearing, you know, and it was so helpless, I think, hearing from what you're saying. Wow, it sounds horrible.
And this Nova survivor, I think it really, like, it got to my head to understand how bad the situation was because the moment that we showed the images of Nova, and those were the only things that we had from the survivors they sent to everywhere, they put it in social media. And only from looking at the images, I see this man like sitting down and starting to scratch himself kind of like maniacally, like feeling kind of a PTSD attack right in front of me before he got in for an interview.
This was like
How soon was this?
This was on October 8th.
Wow.
That was the, like, I understood something really bigger was happening because I never saw someone having a PTSD attack right in front of me like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was frightening. While he was telling the stories, all the producers around us started crying.
Yeah.
Like, we really didn't
Everyone
know how
was
to
in
react.
Shock. Everyone was in shock. Wow, I can't even imagine on October 8th being in such a position where you need to not only be in touch with the people that just survived the worst terror attack ever in our history, but also having to be professional, I guess, in that sense, right? And deal with that. So how long were you there for?
In I24 News? I was there for 2.5 years. So
basically all of the war also?
Most of the war. I stayed there from... Yeah, I stayed there all the way to January last year, 2025. So I didn't see the end of the war, but most of the war I've got to see. There was many events. There's a time also that there was a terror attack in Ranana. It was right next to where I normally get the bus. Things that happen by chance in this country. I came to work in the morning. I already reached Tel Aviv from Ranana. And my boss calls me and say like, Fabio, we don't have people for the afternoon. Can you come back later? I was like, come on, man. I'm almost reaching the station. Can I just go to it? He's like, okay, you can. If I had came back, I would be there exactly when it happened.
Wow.
With the car ramming against it's not even soldiers, it was just civilians who mm-hmm. were waiting in the street. I think, if Insane. I'm not mistaken, one old lady died, mm-hmm. a 70-year-old old lady.
Wow.
Yeah. At the same time, October 7 changed very much the perspective, because I saw from October 8 all the groups were pushing against Israel. Mm-hmm. We had in Australia, that was really like shocking. When they were screaming, "Gas the Jews."
Yeah. October 8th, yeah.
Like, this is not even a week. They didn't even grasp what was the situation. They were already chanting that Israel is a problem, that terrorism is justified. They didn't even know the numbers of 1,200 people mm-hmm. killed.
And Israel hadn't even done anything yet.
Yeah.
Gaza, still Hamas even.
Listen, there were still a lot of, like, combatant missions going on in the south, like a couple within the days after, like on yep. October 8th. Yeah, you country. Still had terrorists in the country.
I think in October 9 or 10, we had our reporter Nicole Zedek coming there in the south, and that was a very controversial interview because she was informed of 40 babies killed, and then they were like, "Oh, it wasn't really 40; it was like 9, but still, it's babies." Later, she got the right information. But she was there in Kfar Aza listening to shots because the military was there. And she mm-hmm. was the only journalist in the field with the military trying wow. to reconquer the city back to Israel because it was full of terrorists. And the terrorists also, like, they put bombs and grenades
yeah.
on themselves in order, like, if you touch the person, explodes. Seeing all this stuff going on, like, with the media perspective, it was like it felt many times that I don't know what is happening. I don't know how to fight this war. Mm-hmm. We receive a lot of information from Reuters, mm-hmm. and this is something that is important to understand. If you're outside of Israel, or even inside, most of your information comes from Reuters, AP.
We have like 5 big top agencies in the world. So like Reuters, AP, EFE, they're like big agencies. People don't understand like news, like the concept of agencies and channels. And, you know, a small news channel in Brazil who has nobody in Israel, they'll take their information from these big news agencies. Sorry. Yeah.
No, exactly. That is their work. And if you see something on Globo, if it is not recorded by people from Globo, They are from Reuters or AP.
They buy, right? They have like this mm-hmm. they buy the subscription.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Even the New York Times sometimes like publishes stuff yeah. from agencies.
So this is something that you need to understand. The moment that the information is there, the whole world is looking at it, if it is correct or not.
Spreads mm-hmm. like wildfire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had a fight with Reuters, and it got to some people inside Reuters that they cut videos from October 7th. They didn't show bodies. They didn't show what was going on. It felt like the Hamas people were coming to the kibbutzim just to hang out and have some fun time in the area. And what really happened was that that guy was a UNRWA officer, was kidnapping bodies from dead civilians mm-hmm. who were in the kibbutz.
We had an AP photographer.
Yeah.
AP is the biggest news agency in the world. Or Reuters also. I think Reuters is top two, maybe. But and he was taking pictures yeah. of mm-hmm. dead bodies. And
the celebrations. Yeah, the
insanity.
And for you to, like, having to fight this whole system to say, like, I am fine that you have biased people inside of it. You, like, AP has the photographer. They are showing only the reality. For every one video about Israel, and that was one of the issues with Israel, most of the videos from Israel, they come directly from or Dovid Tzahal or the government. So it's only official videos. Mm-hmm. From Gaza, anyone shoots. So you have, like, for every one video from Israel, there is, like, 20 from Gaza that you cannot even be sure what is real, what is not. I'm sure that a lot of it is real. And just making sure that we know that there is a disaster there. But at the same time,
there's a lot of Pollywood.
Yes. And you have to be able to differentiate. And because they only want quantity over quality, they don't. So I had to start this fight with them in order for them to finally sent the whole video with the guy from UNRWA kidnapping bodies, and just the fact that I had to fight with them to show something so like.
Yeah, no, it's not in most media's narrative to show the truth. I had a journalist come to me. It was still in October of 2023. He was a German journalist, and he said, "Rachel, I was there in the south. I saw things with my eyes. I saw what ISIS did in Iraq and Syria to little girls. Hamas is worse." Yep. He literally looked at me and said, "Hamas is worse than ISIS. ISIS does not do what Hamas did, and yet I cannot report on it because it is not, you know, in the agenda and the narrative that the company he works for, that they want to push, the news agency that he works for." And it's insane because, you know, it doesn't matter how much we talk to journalists and how much we try to show the truth. At the end of the day, the only thing that's going to be shown is the only thing that the heads of these agencies want to push out.
Yep.
How do you challenge that? Like, how do you combat this phenomenon as a news channel, as a journalist?
Well, we have a few paths. First of all, because we are subscribers, we manage to get contacts in the emails there. But the second way is through using the community. You have to use social media. Like, everything now is a fight, being online or out of the offline. I posted the videos showing exactly like the comparison of one and the other, where it was cut, how it was cut,
and exposing Reuters.
Exposing the whole situation. It got through friends that are also journalists. They got someone contact me on Instagram from Reuters and saying like, "I don't know if it's possible, like it's not the same video, it's not the same frame." It's like, yes, because the frame was cut. So you can see here, like, this is the video directly from Reuters. Tell your bosses.
It was manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at that point, there is kind of the argument that maybe it's too late. Like, we can go and kind of try to reverse the damage, but it's done, you know? Like,
no, it was good that they showed the reality at least. But yes, if it is, again, like, if it is not news, if it doesn't happen exactly now, it's already old news.
Mm-hmm. For sure. We also have a lot of titles, like headlines. Mm-hmm. Even before the war, I mean, that's pretty much what we did at the spokesperson's unit all the time, calling journalists to change headlines. Because when they say, you know, Palestinian shot dead, and what actually happened is a terrorist shot at people, shot at forces, and then he was shot dead. It's not that he was just this innocent guy walking around. He had a gun. He was shooting at people. Yep. It makes sense that he was shot dead. He was, you know, an imminent threat. And then Hamas goes out, makes a statement and says, like, this was our guy. This was our guy. So it's not a random Palestinian. And we have to call up, you know, whoever it was, from New York Times to Washington Post to Reuters to AP, and say, Hamas literally, you know, took responsibility for the attack. And yet you're not even, they never use the word terrorist, but you're not even saying combatant. You're not even saying, you know, mentioning the fact that this guy is related to a terror organization. So, and then after the fact, a lot of the times they would change the headline or add, you know, a certain mention. But
most times they don't.
A lot of times they don't.
But what is it relevant
it's
anymore?
It's not, because the damage has been done. And also a lot of research shows that people a lot of times just look at headlines on their phones. Yeah. So that's also very, you know, manipulative in that
way. I don't know if you check this also, because I check Reuters, AP, everything. I still do from time to time to make sure that if anything changed, you know. Mm-hmm. And they always put doubt in Israeli operations. They never put it in the Palestinian.
Israel says.
Israel
alleged.
Claims.
Alleged. Israel says.
Images of alleged attack to Hezbollah regions. It never says anything about when you say like about the Palestinians, it's yes, Palestinians killed by Israelis. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say like alleged whatever, alleged terrorists or whatever.
And when it's something super obvious, terror attack in the streets of Ra'anana, let's say, Israel says there was a maybe attack where maybe an old woman died.
Let's be honest, they can check it way easier. They can check information in Gaza.
100%, 100%. Wow, so that must have been very interesting, like being in this, it's the war of, like the online war kind of aspect of it. And then eventually you became deputy academic director at Reichmann University.
Yes.
How was that transition?
It was an interesting transition. Also, just wanted to comment the work for the Spanish show, just to get out of the whole of the war. We also managed to create some connections between Israel and the Latin American world. Mm-hmm. We had a delegation from the president of Argentina, Javier Milei. We covered everything. I even managed to take a photo with him. We had the president of Paraguay. We had a lot of things that feel like, amidst all this craziness, there were countries that helped us and there were countries that supported us, mm-hmm. mainly Argentina and Paraguay, and they made sure to show it, while Lula wasn't very helpful. So it's important to know that even with all this mess, even with all this fight, Qatar, everything, Israel still has some friends. Mm-hmm. And about my job here, it was kind of like a transition, but at the same time, not so much. It's a perfect mix of everything that I learned in the past. Because mm-hmm. I study business, administration. I focus more on the administration part. Administration and government. So now working in the government school as someone who is kind of like a managing position. I'm below Daphne and I try to make everything that she envisions a reality. Mm-hmm. That really works out with all my skills. At the same time, I'm always trying to, as I said before, in the army, everything, I was trying to improve everything that's possible. So I'm trying to get new opportunities for the students. I want to talk to them. I want to understand what are the problems, what this university can be better, and what can we fix? Because I think that it's very, very important not to do the kind of like basa sababa, that it's mm-hmm. very common. It's kind of like,
what does that mean? What does that mean?
Basa sababa, great way of translation. Let's see. It's kind of like, there are problems like, okay.
Yeah. Like whatever.
Whatever. Doesn't matter.
We'll
like
live with it, you know?
Yeah. I'm never like that. I'm always, let's find a solution. Let's understand mm-hmm. there is a problem and let's find a solution. I think that's also important for mm-hmm. the leaders of not only this country, but everywhere. Don't go for the... for the worse the better, as long as like my public is happy and I show that I hate the other guy, everything works. Mm-hmm. No, like try to do the best for your institution, for your country. And I'm trying to do that in this program.
Amazing. So you're in touch with students and like what does your job entail?
I'm in charge of so many hats. I'm in charge of the internship program. So we're expanding it. As of now, we have over 30 opportunities. We have around 26 currently. So I'm connecting also because of my life, the army, the university, mm-hmm. this, that. I'm connecting everyone that I met throughout this life to say, hey, can you give an opportunity for the students? So a lot of the organizations, people from Sharaka, for instance, I met Alice Anis, who studied here also. I met her years ago. I said, you're working there. Do you have an opportunity for us? Mm-hmm. I met with my girlfriend, Danielle. She's the researcher for NGO Monitor. So let's find an opportunity there.
So you're helping students get their first foot kind of off the door with like their future and with opportunities in Israel mm-hmm. in general. That's amazing. Yeah. I don't even think I know other universities in Israel.
I think that's like what they say is so unique and special about Reichman University, you know, like not to do so much PR, like to make this a PR podcast, but that's what they say, like all these special programs and opportunities that you really can't get like this kind of tailored environment anywhere else.
And the focus is really to show what is the world of government like, because mm-hmm. I'm not looking for, okay, we're going to have a world of government, do research, that's it,
yeah,
over. No, I want practical issues. I want them to work with media. I want them to work with also research centers. I want to work with social issues. Mm-hmm. Anything that can help the students to find out what are they looking for? Mm-hmm. Are they looking to work with counterterrorism? Are they looking to work with policy? Maybe change the country, learn to like be the leaders of the next generation, go to diplomacy, work in the Ministry of the Hoods, the foreign ministry. Anything that I can do, I'm going to be doing to ensure that the students will have these opportunities.
What qualities, in your opinion, do you think these next leaders need to possess, like especially mm-hmm. Israeli students or Jewish students living in Israel in this world filled with conflict?
a lot of patience. Patience is very important. You have to understand, you have to adapt to new realities. There's going to be problems and you have to learn with them. So if you're patient, you can calm yourself enough to, in order to do changes into shaping a better reality. I think that now with social media and with the phones and everything, people want very immediate solutions. Most of the times, they don't work out. Mm-hmm. So be patient, people.
Amazing, amazing advice. All right, and our last question for the podcast today, what is one message that you have for our listeners that you would like to share? Maybe something that people don't really understand about Israel or Israelis, or what you wish to say to them?
Search for knowledge.
Wow.
Okay, you don't get it. It's a joke about it's a Brazilian joke about the E.T. Bilu. I'll show you later. Search E.T. Bilu. It's a great piece of Brazilian news. Anyway, he does search knowledge. But the main thing is, come to Israel. You will only understand what is the reality here. Like, don't come straight mm-hmm. to Aliyah. Come with an open mind to understand how society works, and go to different places. Go to places that are touristic, but go to places that are not, and shape your own understanding of the country. This whole place is not an active war zone everywhere. This place is more calm than normally people would think of. So relax, come, enjoy, explore, and then form your own opinions.
Amazing. Thank mm-hmm. you so much. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity. I'm Rachel Escondri.
And I'm Rachel Safdie. And we'll see you here next time with another Untold Story.